Okay, here we are. Hello, good evening. Welcome to this warm and inviting tent. It's very cold outside. The police helicopter is above us, but we are here to discuss the role of the state on the road to 90% emissions reduction. I am Mona. I'm involved in both the workshops and the meetings working groups, and I've been asked to facilitate this evening. I would like to introduce our four wonderful panelists, which is to my left, George, who is an environmental campaigner and writer. Say hello to George. Next comes Almud, full-time volunteer for Biofuel Watch, but she's speaking in a personal capacity. Hello, Almud. Next comes Keir, who works with and for the magazine Turbulence. Here it is, Ideas for Movement. Hello, Keir. And last but not least, Janus from Denmark. He's a climate activist for the climate activist network called Climax, preparing, amongst other things, for the Copenhagen Conference 2009 and the protests against it. Welcome. Okay, before I hand the microphone to George, I want to explain a bit how we thought this evening and this discussion might be most interesting to all of us. The idea is that each of the speakers has 5 minutes for a presentation, that then, to create an interesting discussion amongst the speakers, there's another round of maybe 3 minutes each where they can refer to what the other speakers have said, and then we will open to you, your questions, your statements, and I hope we'll have a great discussion. Now, unfortunately, George has to leave at shortly before 9, so I would ask all our speakers to keep it really sweet and short. Yeah. So now the question is, what should the role of the state be? We hear the helicopters. We know that a lot of us think the state is an entity we do not really want to call upon. But then on the other hand, how are we to get that 90% reduction without a state that will push it through? This is the main question we are asking, and our panelists will tell us what they think about that.
Thanks very much, Mona. Thanks, everyone, for being here. This fantastic climate camp. Went to the last year's one. This one looks even better, and this is where hope lies. So thanks, everyone, for being here. Now, in every other walk of life, you can be an anarchist, a statist, a communist, a monetarist. But climate change, the problem is so pressing and so great that there is really only one ism which allows you to make the right decisions, and that's pragmatism. We are faced with challenges which overwhelm any other political response, in fact, which are far greater than the ideologies which we might try to throw at them. We might try to throw at this problem. And while we must do everything we can to find the necessary solutions to prevent runaway climate change, we must not use it as an opportunity to just try to squeeze climate change into a pre-existing political agenda. And what this means is that we must face issues which are often uncomfortable, discomforting to us. We must make alliances with people that we don't like very much because of their politics. But herein lies the greatest strength of the environment movement, that it is the most politically diverse movement in history. It embraces people from every known part of the political spectrum and quite a few which are completely off the radar. And you just look around this room, if you question people hard about their political beliefs, you will find a very wide range of those beliefs, and we're just a small cross-section. Environmentalism allows us to make alliances with people with whom we could not possibly make alliances under any other circumstances. I remember during a meeting for the Newbury Bypass, in the front row were all these brigadiers with tweed suits and enormous moustaches. In the middle were all these sort of ordinary burghers of Newbury. And in the back there were all these people with pierced noses and dreadlocks and all the rest of it. And I thought, nowhere else on earth would these people come together to do anything other than scream at each other. But here we all are backing exactly the same cause. And that's what environmentalism does. It is potentially a great unifier. And we must be careful not to mess that up by rigidly sticking to a pre-existing political agenda and trying to squeeze things in. And the dangers of this are quite evident. If you look, for instance, at the Tory policy on energy, there you will find that while quite a few top Tories are really taking climate change extremely seriously, and interestingly, want to go much further in some respects than the Labour government does. And there's potential for common cause here. But they have two major problems. One is that ideologically, if not in practice, they say they want to get the state off our backs, and they, despite the fact they want to form the state, and in some ways they're great enthusiasts for big government when it comes to crushing civil liberties and to arming ourselves up and all the rest of it, in other ways they claim to be for the minimal state. At the same time, they have a membership which is very much against wind farms because they put certain landscape values above preventing runaway climate change, and that means that they're boxed into a position of having to support microgeneration as their primary response to producing electricity in a carbon-constrained world. Now, all the figures that I've seen show very clearly that microgeneration might be able to take us to 10, 20, perhaps 30% cuts, but nowhere near the 90% plus cut which we require if we're to prevent 2 degrees of global warming and to prevent runaway climate change. Similarly, I come across many people, market fundamentalists sometimes, sometimes anarchists, who favour a voluntary approach to dealing with the problem. And the fundamental problem with the voluntary approach is that it just doesn't work. People tend, whatever their ideology might be, whatever they say they're trying to do, their use of energy tends to rise pretty much in concert with their income. And I've lost count of the number of middle-class greens I know who buy organic cheese and do their recycling religiously, but have an Aga and a heated conservatory and take all their holidays in Florida and are able, through this wonderful cognitive dissonance, which we're all so good at, to reconcile those things in their heads by just ignoring the contradictions and to see themselves as remaining true to their green ideals. But even when voluntarism does work, it doesn't work. So, for instance, you give up your car. That's a brilliant decision. That's exactly the sort of thing you should be doing. And all you do is to create more space on the road for someone to drive a less efficient car than you would have driven. Unless there is an enabling state which comes along and says, we're going to take away road space from cars, your decision is meaningless. It becomes meaningful only in the context of wider public policy. At the bigger level still, if you look at people's attempts to improve their energy efficiency, you see a massive problem in the form of something called, delightfully, the Chasum-Brooks postulate, which shows that, bizarrely and paradoxically, energy efficiency can actually lead, in the absence of a regulatory framework, to an increase in energy use. The reason being that energy efficiency in the more energy-intensive industries means that the implicit price of energy that they're using falls, they become better investment opportunities, more money flows towards them, and the total energy used across the economy rises. What these two examples show is that, A, you need something, an entity which is capable of dealing with a technological change on a very large scale indeed. And I'm talking in particular here about very widely distributed macro renewables connected together by high voltage direct current lines into a continental or even transcontinental supergrid as being one of the very few solutions which can take us to that 90% plus cut that we need, which then requires a political entity, a state or something bigger in its geographical spread than a state, instruments, organs of global governance, which are just and democratic, which can then make that thing work. There's no point in trying to control part of a grid. Part of a grid doesn't work. Part of a grid is meaningless. You have to have some oversight of the entire grid system if that grid system is to work. And what we see here is that the technological requirement drives to a large extent the political requirement. We also see from the other example that if voluntarism doesn't work, you require a degree of compulsion if you are to have a universal across-the-board cut in emissions. And that, again, requires a political entity which is capable of compelling. In both cases, we see here an argument for the role of the state. Now, I hate the impositions of the state. I hate the wars it wages. I hate the corruption. I hate the lies. I hate the crushing of civil liberties. I hate the helicopters. I hate the police at the gate. But I recognise at the same time that we have to make use of it as an instrument, because if we don't, we will fail. Now, I have talked about the smaller part of the problem. It might seem like quite a big one, without even mentioning where the real issue with climate change lies, which is the issue of economic growth. At the moment, the global economy is growing, according to the IMF, by 3.7% a year. That means that it doubles every 19 years, and then doubles again, and then doubles again. This is exponential growth, ladies and gentlemen. Now, as the equations by Professor Roderick Smith at Imperial College show, an inherent function of exponential growth is that your total resource use through that period, any one doubling period, is equal to the resource use, we're talking economic resources in this case, in the entire period preceding it. In other words, in the next 19 years, if we sustain a rate of 3.7% growth, we will use as many economic resources as the world has used in the past 3 million years. And then in the following 19 years, we will use twice as many again. And then twice as many again, 4 times, 8 times, 16 times, 32 times, 64 times. The exponential series just keeps on going. And one very clear pragmatic response to the challenge of climate change is to see that our biggest long-term problem is economic growth, because no technologies we throw at it. No approach, however clever, however well thought out, can possibly keep up with growth at that rate. Now, the more fundamental problem which you run into as soon as you recognise that is that economic growth is inherent to any system which even vaguely resembles capitalism. Now, I don't say this as an ideological point at all. I'm just trying to be a pragmatist here and trying to look at this purely through the eyes of someone trying to come up with practical solutions. And I come up against this brick wall, which is that even the most primitive form of capitalism depends upon one function, which is usury, the lending of money at interest. If you put out £100 and you expect to get £105 back, one of two things has to happen. Either your money supply increases by 5%, or the velocity of circulation of that money through the economy increases by 5%. In either case, the increased money supply or increased velocity becomes inflationary if it is not matched by a concomitant increase in goods and services. Therefore, by its very nature, capitalism, the lending of money at interest, even if it, in its most primitive form, has to drive economic growth. It has to drive economic growth right across the spectrum of goods and services. Otherwise, it collapses into hyperinflation. In other words, we see here a problem which I find very, very hard to get to grips with. How do we deal with the issue of capitalism, which is absolutely fundamental to the issue of climate change, without empowering the state so much that it crushes the very breath out of us? I hope that's one of the topics that we can discuss tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George. Now, Almud, George said that there is a role for the state and it should be quite a strong role. So what is your idea?
Right. What I thought I was going to start speaking about is really by defining the crisis we're in, the climate crisis we're in, and the scale of the crisis. And from there, really looking at what it means for adequate responses and for the kind of changes that we need to make. And I think, you know, having done that, we can look at the role of the state in terms of, you know, putting forward or blocking solutions. First of all, I think it's quite difficult to call for, I find it quite difficult to simply speak about a climate crisis, because the crisis we are facing is not just a climate crisis. It's basically a converging multiple crisis, each of which will basically kill most of us if we don't deal with it. We are obviously having the immediate crisis of global warming caused primarily so far by fossil fuel burning. But we are also at the same time dealing with the massive destruction of virtually all of the Earth's life support systems. So we are not just dealing with the heating up of the atmosphere, but at the very same time with an industrial model, industrial society and economy that is destroying the entire Earth's life support systems. And by that I mean we're destroying biodiversity, which is absolutely essential for regulating the climate. We're destroying forests, we're destroying ecosystems, we're destroying the world's soil at a rate where, you know, agriculture, if this continues, will cease to function. And, you know, we will go into food shortages, even irrespective of global warming. And we're dealing with, you know, destruction of marine life, we're dealing with the depletion of fresh water. So we're really looking at a very massive, you know, crisis of the Earth systems, caused by, I would say, the industrial exploitation through our economy of the systems. And just to give you a very, very brief example of what I mean by the crisis being interlinked and why each of those crises is absolutely essential to be addressed, I read one of the most frightening studies earlier this year about climate change by somebody called Dan Ovaro, who actually writes about deep ocean plankton. And saying how deep ocean plankton is essential for regulating the nutrient recycling of the oceans and maintaining the carbon cycle on which we all depend. In other words, if we don't have healthy, you know, deep sea ecosystems, there's a reasonable chance that alone, regardless of anything else we do, can bring about global climate collapse. Now, that means that, for example, bottom trawling, you know, hoovering up the ocean bed on a massive scale by, you know, a small number of industrial fisheries can bring about climatic collapse. Now, what does it mean in terms of adequate responses and responses put forward by the states and by governments at the moment? What's very obvious to me is that at the moment there's a lot of talks about, you know, states responding to, increasingly states saying that they respond to climate change. The states that are now denying the existence of at least the climate crisis are in a very, very small and vanishing minority. But increasingly we are having big solutions put forward, including by individual governments, including by the UNFCCC, which not only do not address the crisis and do not in any way halt the destruction of ecosystems, of life support systems, or halt even the rise in fossil fuel emissions, you know, let alone massively reverse it. But a lot of the solutions being put forward or being pursued now actually worsen the crisis. They either worsen it because, for example, carbon trading delays and avoids the ending of fossil fuel use. And or they worsen the crisis because in the name of going low carbon, they actually replace fossil fuels with some fossil fuel use with the acceleration of the destruction of the biosphere. For example, through agrofuels, through so-called carbon sink, massive tree plantations, mainly in the global south, or through big hydro dams. So I think what we need to be aware of is that, you know, ultimately we are dealing primarily with a crisis, with a multiple converging crisis, which is caused as George said, by economic growth, but I would also say very much caused by the massive overconsumption by global minority, and that global minority mainly being located in the global north. And obviously by the fact that we have an economy based on growth, and generally an economy based on an industrial society, based on the industrial exploitation of resources, of fossil fuels, through mining, and of the entire biosphere. And I think for us as campaigners, I would agree about being pragmatic about the role of the state, but I think if being pragmatic also means for me to understand that, the state primarily at the moment has, acts in a way that is maintaining this basic industrial exploitation-based models. And now I don't have any answers of, how we overcome it, but I think, that's for me the starting point of how we speak about climate solutions and how we speak about, where we see the massive changes that need to happen and the role of governments at the moment.
Thank you very much, Almut. So if the state primarily seeks to maintain the growth economy and our industrialized society, what role do you see for the state?
So when people talk about the state, I wonder what state they're talking about. Are we talking about the UK state? Are we talking about the Brazilian state? The Chinese state? That's quite different. The Somalian state? Does that exist? And the reason I'm saying that is because, or perhaps we'll have international agreements between states, right? But the reason I'm saying it is because there are no actually existing states that can solve the problem of climate change. To illustrate this, I want to talk about when Lula became president of Brazil. This is a process, the end result of a process of a 20-year struggle of mass movements aimed to get institutional power, in order to change the world. When they get in, this is one of the one of Lula's leading aides, Frei Beto. He makes this statement. I'll just read it out because it's quite interesting. He says, "We are in government, but we are not in power. Power today is global. The power of large companies, the power of finance capital." This is the problem that that the anti-capitalist movement, the anti-globalization movement, the counter-globalization movement, the movement of movements, whatever you want to call that, but the whole movement from Seattle, this is the problem. This is the problem that it was around, and that problem has not gone away, There isn't a state, there isn't a magic button which says state, we press it, and the problems go away, right? Because I'm not being idealistic here. I'm being pragmatic. We have to be pragmatic. We have to deal with the problems we're facing here and now. We can't just wish that there was something, a state out there, which would solve everything for us. All right? We have to start with the problems we face in this tent now, and that's pragmatism. We start from the problems in this tent, and then we see where we go forward. And I do agree about the urgency of the issue. And I do think that also means that we can't just have, an attitude that we can keep on having noble but pure defeats. And then someday, perhaps, we will prevail someday, which has been the attitude that you can fall into. We will prevail and we'll stay pure. What we're talking about is something new. We need to create something new, okay? Which means we don't know how it will go. We don't know how things will pan out, all right? So we don't know what the role of the state will be. I love science fiction. It's one of my favorite genres, right? But I'm not going to base my politics on it, right? I wonder what will happen in the future. This is what I think will happen in the future. There'll be flying cars. Basically, we have to start what our problems in this tent now, and we work out. That's what pragmatism is. So I don't know what the role of the state will be, and I'm open to ideas that the role of the state could act in various ways. I strongly suspect that we are already experiencing what the role of the state will be in climate change. Right? When you try to get into this tent, into this field, you get searched. There's a helicopter overhead. There are police coming in to try and disrupt this tent, this field, okay? No, this isn't some sort of accident. this is basically how the vast majority of the world's population experience the state, right, on a day-to-day level. Which also brings me to another 90% I wanted to raise, okay? Because 90% of the world's, we could say that 90% of the world's population are more or less powerless. Okay, and there's 10% who perhaps are powerful. I'm obviously making that figure up, but it's a nice little connection. And that leads me to something else, which is I want to make this very important point that we are not all in this together, all right? The rich have the ability to tolerate much larger levels of climate change than the poor, okay? It's Barrett houses that get built on floodplains, not mansions, okay? You know, the rich can get, you know, are not living in Bangladesh, but if they were, they could move out, okay? They have the resources to insulate themselves from the risks of climate change. They can tolerate more climate change than the poor. How do we know? Because the poor are already dying from climate change, right? So the point I'm making is, you know, that in order to get 90% carbon reductions, we need to empower the 90% of the world's population to stand up for their interests, okay? In order to get 90%, we need to mobilize the 90%. There's only one, you know, one of the things about whatever the role of the state will be, it is only by having massive social movements will you even have a chance of having the massive transformations that are necessary to get to 90%. You know, that is our main problem, okay? That's the main thing we need to do. And that's the whole point of this camp, you know, we experience the dynamism of being in a mass movement. And that's the sort of thing can be infectious and can spread. It has happened before. You know, we have to really try and make it happen now. So basically, that's the road to 90% that I'm interested in. It's the 90% of the world's population. So one way we could think about it is, right, are we orientated towards that top 10%? Do we want to get the world's governments in this tent to talk about climate change? Or do we want to get 90% of the world's population in this tent to talk about their lives and what to do with it?
Thank you very much, Keir. Now, if we're talking about empowering the movement or the movements, we might also be talking about Denmark, Copenhagen, 2009. Most of you will know, some of you may not know, that the next big climate conference is going to take place in Copenhagen in December 2009. That is the place where decisions are going to be made by states, by representatives of states, about how things are going to go for the next few years. So we have somebody here from Denmark, Janus, who is from an organization with a group that is already thinking about what to do about this conference. Let's hear from him.
Hello, everybody. Before I begin, I would like to invite everybody here to come to Copenhagen in 2009 and also the summer before when we have a big international climate camp. She just said that that the states, I'm supposed to talk about the role of the state. And I have a problem with talking about that, because my experience with the state is the last time they got together, they made the Kyoto Protocol. And the only thing the Kyoto Protocol did was make a new market, a new circulation of money. The only thing it actually did was to create a whole new market where money could be produced, and therefore we could produce even more material, which produced even more carbon, and which destroyed even more ecosystems. So forgive me if I don't trust the state that much. I do believe that we would need cooperation to solve this problem. Of course we do. Historically, the state is, yes, we talked about the state as you tried to talk a little about it. What state are we talking about? Is what kind of state are we talking about right now? what kind of state is it that are having this meeting in Copenhagen? And it is a capitalist state, and it is a state with a certain ideology. It is a state who represents the rich people. And it's a state that excludes the poor people of the world. It's a state that okay. Just a minute, I have to get back online. Okay, the problem with this state is that I'm not used to talking in English like this, so I just... Okay, the problem with this state is that it is a state that protects the rich, of course. That's the kind of state we are facing. It's a state which will... When we reach this, if we don't get this state, and I don't believe that we will, if we don't get this state to change its focus on profit, if we don't get the state to change that, and we really need to gather our strength to do that, then when the state reaches the state of climate catastrophe, when the climate change, then the state will react as the state have done many times throughout history, and the question is if the worst thing is going to be the climate catastrophe in itself, or if it's going to be the reaction from the state. We have already heard. I don't know if you are familiar with the concept of 40 Europe. Recently they have made a new deal with the countries along the Mediterranean and the countries along there to prevent immigration, and they have these drones. What's happening? Oh shit.
What is happening? Everybody, please keep cool. Keep cool. Yes? Keep your head. They are not going to get us out of here. Stay together. Stay with people you know. Look out for each other, please. Yeah.
Oh, thanks. What are you part of? What organization?
Let's stay here because we can still do something with the mic. We won't have a mic. Yes.
I hope we get a second round. Yeah. I hope we get a chance of a second round.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good idea.
Seven. It's not worth everybody going out. I'm going up.
I hope that we can keep the discussion up. We don't know if this is a false alarm, and I would like us to try and go on. Yes? Could you please come back in? I would like to go on. Let us not, as you said right now, she's absolutely right. Let the police should not be setting our agenda. We want to set the agenda. So could the speakers please come back? Janusz, George. Yeah. It seems Yeah.
So can somebody try and get to comms? Yeah.
Could somebody try and check with comms so that we can inform you if this is a false alarm? It seems to have been a false alarm. So would you please come back in? We would like to go on with our very interesting discussion. Don't you find this an interesting discussion? Okay. Now, unfortunately, the speaker who is supposed to be speaking right now has left. But as his 5 minutes, anyway, I know this is pushing it a bit, but I do want this to go on. And remember, George has to leave shortly before 9. So I would suggest that if Janos is not round the corner somewhere here, anyone seen Janos? Okay. The cops might have seen him. That I hand the mic to George now, and please keep it short and sweet, because we don't have a lot of time and we want to allow for questions and we want to allow for your ideas in the audience.
Thanks, Mona. I think these positions so far are not that incompatible, and not as incompatible as they might originally seem. Of course, we are not arguing for the state as it currently exists to carry on as it currently exists. But we've got two separate issues here that we're looking at. One is that, as we know, there is so little time, and we have to start acting straight away, and we have to use whatever the most effective tools are right now to start that action. And one of those tools, much as we might regret it, has to be the state, partly because it's there, and if it isn't part of that solution, it's going to be part of the problem, but partly also for the reasons that I talked about at the beginning. But at the same time, we must, of course, continually fight to get the state off our backs in other ways, and to ensure that this becomes the democratic state that it is not. But democracy is never something which comes from above. Democracy is something made by the people, and it's made by the constant challenges and constant prodding of the state by the people. And democracy is only as good as the constant challenges that it receives. Democracy is the challenges. It does not exist in isolation. Now, if we can just take the example that Janos raised of the Kyoto Protocol, who tanked the Kyoto Protocol? Who ensured that it was so full of loopholes? The loopholes were so big you could drive an oil supertanker through them. Who ensured that the targets were far too little too late? Al Gore. Al Gore, he led the American delegation, which just put its foot down on any and every measure which might have made that into an effective treaty. Why did he do that? Because the Senate had already voted 95-0 not to accept any such treaty. Why had the Senate done that? Because every single one of those senators, Democrat and Republican, had their arms twisted right up behind their backs by the energy companies who were paying them. And the problem there was not the problem that it was a state that was involved, but it was a state which is entirely bought and sold by its campaign finance arrangements, organized, in other words, by big business. It's a state in the pocket of big business. And our quest here must not be to say, when faced with a challenge like that, no state, but to say, if we're going to have a state, it must be in the pockets of the people, not in the pockets of business.
Thank you very much, George. So we need to change the state, but in what ways?
Well,
go on, Albert.
Sort it out, yes.
Get on with it.
Right. I think where I would come from at the moment is, you know, having looked at the crisis we have, you know, to really start by saying, you know, who formulates the solutions and what are the things we actually need to do. And what we actually need to do, first of all, primarily, is to find solutions that keep virtually all the fossil fuels that still are underground there where they are, and to stop the destruction of the biosphere on all its levels. Now, in doing that, there's no, you know, what that will mean is on each and every issue, of course, we will engage with the day-to-day political debate, and we will engage, you know, we will have to deal with, you know, the government, the state response to that, and see, you know, in each case, what's the most effective way of saving ecosystems and keeping fossil fuels where they are. I thought I would reply quite a lot to a bit to what Keir said about the importance of social movements, because in terms of, you know, the successes, and I think we're all very clear, you know, of the successes that there have been in terms of, you know, stopping destruction. And for example, if you look at, you know, one of the ones, you know, the anti-GM movement in the UK, which and across Europe, which had some, you know, quite strong solutions, that was primarily because it came out of a very, very big civil society movement with, you know, quite a diverse one. So I think there's no doubt that, you know, the solutions have to be formulated by civil society and fought for. What I think is really important, I think what's really important for the climate movement at the moment is that we are dealing with global issues. And I think one of the challenges we are facing when we're speaking of social movements is, you know, who defines the solutions? Is it just us as a social movement in the UK and as, you know, people who know about climate change, etc., defining the solutions and putting them forwards? Or are we actually listening to and directly engaging with civil society in the global south, in, you know, in those countries? Are we actually listening to and learning about the solutions from societies and communities that actually live in truly sustainable ways and live truly low carbon lifestyles? You know, are we prepared to, you know, learn, you know, listen and learn, you know, what the real issues are for, say, small farmers, sustainable small farmers, for indigenous peoples, for communities, for, you know, in southern fishing communities that actually do, you know, do live sustainably? Are those the people, you know, are those the societies actually given a chance in formulating, you know, the answers to the crisis, or are they just being put forward, you know, by a minority? So I think where we have a really big challenge, but also, you know, opportunity, is to really, you know, have a more global learning and listening amongst social movements. And one of the really moving things I wanted to mention is that, for example, I was able to listen to quite a few of climate campaigners and climate justice campaigners from Indonesia, and one of the things that really struck me was that, you know, it's quite a different debate amongst Indonesian climate justice campaigners, in that for them, you know, on the ground, when we speak of false solutions, you know, we speak of them, they're not solutions for climate change, but for them a lot of the false solutions are actually at least as devastating as climate change itself is at the moment. And, you know, this is a sort of the understanding and, you know, the false solutions that are being pushed by states, you know, particularly by the global north, but also by the Indonesian state, you know, such as agrofuels in the case of, you know, palm oil, vast big palm oil, more industrial agriculture, some big hydro, etc., that, you know, are really directly affecting climate justice. Well, directly affecting communities on its larger scale is climate change. So, yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, yes, the answers will come from civil society and from social movements, but also from a process of really learning and listening to, you know, to communities as well.
Thank you very much, Alma. So one solution we might look at is learning from the global south, learning from communities. Keir.
Well, I agree with that. I haven't really got a second round thing worked out. But I think one of the dangers I'd sort of think about, if we orientate our politics towards the state, is the danger of, and I think this is the danger of Kyoto and other agreements like that, is the danger of business as usual, but with like just a lick of green paint over the top, basically. And that is a thing that we have to absolutely fight. We have to keep open a space so that we really are pragmatically facing this problem. Do you know what I mean? Because the problem isn't that people have the good idea, the right ideas haven't reached the right people. You know, there are really powerful dynamics, like the dynamics of capitalism, are working in a direction which is, we must continue with business as normal, okay? And that's why it's not a case of, like, we just have to get the right ideas. You have to get a counterforce to that huge dynamism of capital. And there's only one possible counterforce, and that's a dynamism that comes out of mass social change and mass social movements, basically. I think one of the dangers with this, in fact, it's not just a danger that we'll get business as usual, because I think there's a real danger that the poor of the world, including the poor or just normal families of this in this country, are going to get the double whammy. Because the poor get the worst, the most immediate and worst effects of climate change, but they're also at risk of being the ones who pay primarily for the transformations that take place. Okay, I mean, it's a really difficult issue to talk about things like road pricing and so forth. But, you know, if we use market mechanisms, that means you punish, they're aggressive, that means you punish the poor first. The poor pay the price of transformation. Okay. And I think part of what we need to do is try and work out the links between the various crises that are going on at the minute, such as this food crisis that's just happening, hunger riots in 34 countries. Like that's a mass movement, okay? A disjointed, fractured mass movement. That's one of the biggest mass movements in history. It makes 1968 seem like, you know, a storm in a teacup. You know, 34 countries around the world have hunger riots at the minute. There's a reason for that, okay? It's not just, you know, a coincidence. It's because all the structural adjustment programs that took place in the 1980s and all the transformations that have been taking place over the last 30 years have been doing away with sustainable or subsistence agriculture, which has been the dominant agriculture, doing away with that and forcing people into shanty towns. Okay, and it's also forced third world governments not to have a store of grain like they used to, and so you have to go to the global market to get grain, basically. And that's why all of a sudden the whole world, the price of grain goes up, the whole world is in danger of starvation, basically. I'm sort of losing my track here a bit. But my main point is, right, in the transformations that need to take place, who are the agent, okay? And the state is not the agent, right? The state won't go away, and they'll have to be dealt with in various ways, and there'll have to be interaction between it. But the agent is the mass of people, a mass movement, and that is the only thing we can rely on, basically.
Okay, I think I'll talk a little about...
the police are raiding, everyone out!
No, not again. Okay. Please stay, I want to say something. I think I'll talk a little about centralism versus decentralism, because it's kind of if we talk about it theoretically, it's kind of hard to know when is an entity big enough to become a state and so on. So what I want to talk about is how to make people make the nature a part of their culture, because we live in a centralized world, a state where the power to live with nature, the power to produce your own goods, to take responsibility for your surroundings, they are taken away from us. That it's all been institutionalized, it's been industrialized, it's not something that you can feel. We are alienated from nature. Culture is no longer a part of nature. It should be important to reach that point again, and that's where I think that centralization is a bad thing. Because it takes away the power for the people to understand nature, to work with nature, to know what we can take from the nature without damaging it so much that it can't sustain itself anymore. And then we do not destroy it. And if you decentralize a system, if you make people, you give people responsibility to to have responsibility for their own production, have responsibility for their surroundings, just like here. I see people here taking responsibilities that they wouldn't normally do. Normally, I could consider just peeing all around and throwing trash on the street, because it looks like that, and in that society, it's not my responsibility. I have some workers who walk around picking up trash all day, and that's a disgusting system, because it should be something that we all take part of that, so we could quickly get... So we quickly could get rid of the trash, and then everybody could. That would also like prevent that we have a workers' class who only have to take all the shit, and then some rich people who can just lean back. So a decentralized system requires responsible people, and we need responsible people in a world. And we need people to feel, we need people to identify, because we cannot just tell people, this is wrong, this is good, if they do not feel it. And in a system that is centralized, people do not feel it. They cannot see the cause of their actions. People living in Denmark, it's hard for them to understand when they, or in England, it's hard for them to understand that if I go and buy some shoes in a store, and it's absurd that the simple action of buying some shoes in a store actually means that I'm supporting a system keeping child labor, and that's the problem with centralization. It fragmentates the possibility to see connections between your actions and see the consequences of what you're doing. This decentralized system makes you a more responsible person. It makes you a person who are able to see the connection, both the ecological connection, throwing trash, using too much, because if you use too much, you can see how your surroundings are being affected by this, and you are also able to understand how what you buy or what you use affects other people. Yeah, that's what I want to say about the decentralization and centralization mainly.
Thank you, Janos. Now it's your turn, but before we start, I want to give you a message from Alice, who just handed me a note saying that Gate 5 is fine, and they will call her if they need more people, and she will tell us, okay? So you will be told if more people are needed at Gate 5. Stay with us. It's a bit dark in here. I don't know. It's nice. It's natural, but in the dark, maybe you do want to see the speakers. Not bad. Okay, so we've got another 10 to 15 minutes until George has to leave. So we could have here some disco discussions. I like it. Dan has the mic, and we will take your questions now. Maybe it would be good to take like two questions at a time. If you have a specific question to one of the speakers, say it, but you can also just ask questions generally, and someone will answer them. Okay. And you can, of course, also just make points yourself. Thank you, Keir. Would you prefer that? That people make several points here and the speakers have another round at the end? Would that be what you want? Okay, I see some hands here. Yeah? Okay, let's do that. Exactly. That was the idea. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we will have several questions or points. Yeah. Do people maybe want to come in here, the ones standing outside? Because at the back, there's a lot of space here at this side. Yeah. But let's get going with the questions. Okay, Dan. Just a second. We need sound on the mic.
I think it's really important that we recognise that we're a more radical end of the climate movement. And as the more radical end, we have to say the radical truths, and we have to make the climate change issue about capitalism and about economic growth. My question is, considering that, what are we trying to say at Copenhagen? And considering what we've been saying about the fact that the state, the capitalist state, as it stands, will not or cannot tackle climate change effectively, then at the G8 we know what we're doing. You know, we know that we oppose the G8 the way it is, and that we feel that institution has no legitimacy. But what are we saying at Copenhagen? Are we trying to shut down the meeting, or are we trying to keep all those delegates in there to make a decision that we're happy with? What is our tactic there?
Thank you. Over there, I see a hand there. By the way, before Copenhagen happens, of course, the G8 will also happen in July. And guess where? In Italy. Remember Genoa?
The state or no state, that is a question some people may ask. And I think there is a way of bridging the kind of slight death right split, if I may put it that way, between speakers on both ends. I think the movement that we need to build is a unique movement, is a movement we're facing a situation which is unprecedented in human history. And the movement that will be required to actually solve the problem will be a movement which we've never seen, a unique movement, a global movement, a movement which is of enormous power. We all have to build that movement, and I think everyone agrees with that. Now, that same movement that can force change can also replace the state. It will be that powerful, I think. And I think we all can agree that we need to build a mass movement. Whether we think the state can solve the problem or not, we need to build a mass movement. And mass movements are the things which have actually, in my view, have actually made the changes in our society which made it better. Women have got the vote through mass movements. Slavery in the United States was abolished through mass movements. And that's an interesting example, because there you see a mass movement which was so powerful it could completely control the political system. It destroyed the old Whig Party, created the Republican Party. It made Lincoln able to make the Emancipation Declaration. The American Civil War could not have happened without a mass movement opposing slavery, an abolitionist movement. So mass movements are powerful, and they sometimes work behind the scenes, and they're not documented in history. And I think that's the movement we're building. And whether we think the state can solve the problem or not, and I think the point we need to be making at Copenhagen is this: either you solve the problem or we will solve it for you.
Thank you. The next hand was in front here, I think.
There's a few things I'm afraid I disagree with. I don't see the state as an enemy. I've tried to be part of the state. I tried to get elected. I failed. But I have colleagues who are in government, and they are very close to me, and I don't see them as the enemy. But what I do see as a problem is people who don't recognise that administration is a necessary job, and that it's certainly necessary to break laws and to do things without for oneself. But then you have to see that as something which is helping the state get it right, not treat them as animals or evil. And the same goes for the police outside, who I've had lots of conversations with. And I don't see... Yeah. So
thank you.
While you have an us and them thing, you've got a problem, and it's up to you to end that. On the terms of the macro solutions, I'd like macro solutions to work. Greater they do, I don't know if they do. I do know micro works. I know, you know, I see micro communities, micro energy working all around me and growing rapidly, and it works, and it's worked in the past. So don't discredit something which we do know works. It might be the only solution we have worked in Cuba. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. There was another hand in the back over there. And I think after that, I would like to take a round. Okay, one more hand in the back at the left side. And after that, I would like to have a first round because George has to leave soon. Yeah, and I would like to give him the chance to say something.
Hi, I'd just like to go back to something that George was saying about the problem of capitalism, the fact that it requires growth. So he didn't seem to suggest a concrete solution to this profit motive, the need for growth. Now, there's been a solution. It's been around for nearly a century and a half. It's social control and social ownership of the means of production. I mean, capitalism can go on lurching from one crisis to another. It can be economic or it can be a climate crisis, but it is inherently unstable. And, you know, whether it's in a Marxist or a socialist or an anarchist form, the solution to this is democratic control of the means of production. Because think about it, where is the CO2 produced? It is produced at the level of production. It's produced in the power plants. It's produced in the factories. It's produced because people, workers, do not control the things that they produce. And this discussion of the state is all very well, but I think a discussion of capitalism is far more important.
Okay, George.
Thanks very much. Well, I'd just like to build on that last point. If we are talking about social control of the means of production, and I certainly see many virtues in that, we're also talking about the prevention of individual control of the means of production, even down to the small level. Otherwise, you end up undermining the possibility of retaining social control on whatever scale it might be. And this is where the problem lies. The problem lies not with the concept of social control, which I think is a very positive one, but with the concept of preventing any other form of intervention in the economy or engagement in the economy. That's where you get your totalitarian state. And you cannot separate these issues, the issue of capitalism, from the issue of state control. Because certainly the lesson of history so far is that the only way you can suppress capitalism over the long term in even its primitive forms, or indeed suppress individualism over the long term, is to have a state so crushing that it suppresses everything else. Now, I'm not advocating either solution in examining this question. I'm just saying that there is a clash here which we have to recognize. And if you ignore that clash, and if you ignore the past 150 years of history, it suggests that you are not looking at this problem objectively. Now, when it comes to social control and the issue of whether that reduces carbon emissions, well, I wasn't here yesterday, but I understand that Arthur Scargill came and was talking about absolutely about social control of the means of coal production in order to keep producing coal. The two things don't necessarily mean the same thing. We are here primarily, we're here for lots of other reasons as well, but we are here primarily to try to prevent runaway climate change. Our immediate goal is to prevent a new power station from being built just there, which will ensure, especially if it precipitates a whole wave of new such power stations, that runaway climate change will happen. And we have to start from where we are. We cannot start from a utopia of our own design. We have to start from where we are, as even Marx would say, men make their own history, but not in circumstances of their own choosing. The circumstances are the ones that we have to engage with, and we have to start engaging with them right now in August 2008. Yes, by all means, let's try to reshape the social fabric. Yes, by all means, let's try to create a new political system. But our primary task, right here and right now, is to prevent runaway climate change. And if it means using the state, then by God, we have to use it.
Thank you very much, George. Thanks for being here. Hope to see you again. Give him a rousing applause, yeah? Bye. But we have another 10 minutes time, and if we want to go on after that, we can move to the next tent over, because as far as I know, there's going to be a Kaylee in here, and I think we can... Yeah? Do you want to stay? Come on. We have a few more hands, or do you want to say something now or go around first? Okay, the man in the hat back there was actually next. microphone, please.
I think the people who were sat to the right of the stage were failing to address a far longer historical situation than merely the last 150 years. I think what we're dealing with here is quite cataclysmic and is very much a situation that requires immediate action. But we shouldn't do that at the expense of knowing where we are and what's created that situation. And I would argue that that situation has been created by states, historically, and will continue to do. There can be dialogue between the people and states, but states cannot provide the solution. And I really think that if we face this cataclysmic point by going, we'll just get a new set of leaders in to make the same mistakes that have been historically made, then we're doomed to runaway climate change. I really do. That's my belief. Sorry.
Thank you very much. We had a hand way in the back there. Somebody standing up, exactly. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. It's been said, and it is very true, that we are a radical movement. And the argument's been made today that the state is there and we should work within it. And the thing about working within it is to not look at it the way that the three major political parties look at it in the way that they do. They're all competing for the common ground. What we should do is take our radicalism and cause radical change within the state. There is no need for the state to tax any of us for doing work. They can tax the use of land and the tax emissions. There are changes that can be done within the state that are radical and that we should campaign for. And so I think, yes, there is social change needed, but and also, yes, there is a radical approach to shifting the state. And not surprisingly, there's a workshop on it tomorrow.
Thank you very much. I know you're next, but there have been so many men speaking one after the other. I would like to take you next. Is there a workshop on that tomorrow? I would very much welcome it. Over there, Sophie.
Hi, okay. I don't want to repeat the point that Claire made, but for me, it's Copenhagen that really crystallises this in my mind when I'm trying to think about the way this movement is relating to the state. Somehow, with the climate camp, we really, in a very creative way, have managed to circumnavigate the issue because our focus is very much on empowering ourselves through our action and through educating ourselves and through living sustainably. And yet, somehow, at the same time, we managed to create this new political space and effectively lobby decisions in the sphere of government. And sometimes it's really it's really exciting the way that we managed to combine that and not lose the focus on ourselves and the movement building and how important that power is. And that's great. But with Copenhagen, we've got this other challenge, and suddenly we've got to decide how we respond to what's effectively a summit. And I was involved in the mobilisation against the G8, and there, as Claire said, we knew where we stood. I was delegitimising that. that summit. They had no right to make the decisions they were making. And they had, and now we have more or less the same countries coming together in a different form discussing climate change, although they were still discussing climate change in, at the G8. And somehow the idea that we're saying that the issue now is far more important than it was when the G8 was discussing it. Somehow there's more urgency behind this. I mean, the G8 were talking about, you know, global poverty and how they were going to overcome it. And when, especially when we think about how we're relating to international movements, I don't have any answers, but somehow it concerns me that when the G8 came, I was saying, you know, this summit has no authority, has no legitimacy, and now I'm saying, oh no, this is so urgent. Perhaps this is so urgent because I think it's going to affect me. Now I'm prepared to lobby this summit, and I think that's a real concern. I don't know how to resolve it, and it's a real question for us all.
Thank you very much. No, so here in the front, please. Can I see the hands in the back again? It's getting a bit dark here. Okay, then there. Yeah.
My name is Sky. I'm from Indie Media. I've got a question for the panel and also a few points to make. Throughout all this debate, I've heard nothing about the La Maddalena G8 that's happening in July of 2009. So that's something for you to think about, all right? It's going to be happening in the Sardinia group of islands in the Mediterranean on the 6th to the 8th of July. All right. So anybody interested in the La Maddalena G8, come and see me at the back of this tent afterwards, all right? But the question I want to put to the panel is what does the movement do at La Maddalena G8 in July of 2009, 6 months before we get to Copenhagen?
Okay. Thank you. I would like to give Alma the chance because she has said she would like to say something on the Copenhagen question now.
Yeah. Right. I think when we speak about Copenhagen, you know, we obviously speak about UNFCCC, you know, Kyoto Protocol. We have to be very aware that at the moment, based on what is happening, what UNFCCC has turned into is essentially a trade agreement. It's essentially a trade fair. It is an agreement for carbon trading. You know, it is nothing, you know, it's at the moment, you know, what we've got under Kyoto and what is being negotiated, you know, for the post-Kyoto agreement is a carbon trading agreement. And, in terms of being a carbon trading agreement, it will inevitably lead to successes being announced. You know, it will be a successful agreement, but it will not be a successful agreement for people and absolutely not be a successful agreement for the climate if you look at what is being put forward, what is on the table. I'm aware that at the moment the Danish government are already facilitating as the very first preparations of, you know, for the Copenhagen COP, you know, talks about trade, WTO, and industry engagement in influencing negotiations. I think for us, it's absolutely crucial that we go in very much saying that there is no legitimacy for having another carbon trading agreement. And if that is what's been negotiated, then it is just wrong. Let's be very careful that we don't get carried away with talk about targets. Because whether you've got a 10% target or 30% target or 90% target, if your only mechanism is a market agreement, you know, that is inherently flawed and that we know will not work and will make the situation worse, then, you know, the target in itself does nothing. We also have to be very aware that some of the things that will be negotiated at UNFCCC and that will be agreed will be incredibly damaging in terms of, you know, giving more power so far to the World Bank, and particularly what's being on the table, what will almost certainly go through is carbon trading in rainforests and in ecosystems that will essentially privatize or hand over control over large areas of land, you know, on which forest communities depend, indigenous communities depend, to corporate control and to greater state control at a very horrific cost, not just to people, but what I fear actually accelerating, you know, accelerating destruction, deforestation. One point somebody was saying, you know, but we should be lobbying UNFCCC. I have been to one of the COPs, And I would say you will not be able to lobby UNFCCC. The negotiations are taking place entirely behind the scenes. They are, you know, the real negotiations are taking place behind the scenes. There is no NGO. You know, civil society do not generally have an input in them. That doesn't mean that we should say there shouldn't be international action and meaningful international action, action that is being defined by, you know, climate justice movements around the world. I think that's absolutely essential. It's essential that we are there to say, you know, what action should be taken, but that we are also really thinking very much about what type of a summit we're dealing with.
Thank you very much, Almut. I would like to tell you that there is a workshop taking place which is called Copenhagen 2009, What Will Be the Camp's Response? On Thursday from 4:30 to 6:30. So if you're interested, please come to that workshop in the international space. I would like to take the two hands I saw before and then give our other speakers a chance to speak. There was somebody over there who had raised their hand. I think it was you back there.
Yeah, I mean, like many here, I do, of course, have problems with the state, but I wanted to make one quick point, which is how currently there are some states which are radically addressing the environmental problem. And I'm looking the other side of the Atlantic, and certain states in particular, including Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador, who are very democratically, radically transforming their political landscape through the states, and this involves the nationalization of the resources, putting it under workers' control, and a lot of the time kicking out the multinational companies based in countries such as ours. But I mainly just wanted to make the point that there are current statist processes which are addressing the environmental issue quite radically. And yes, there is a workshop on this tomorrow afternoon for anyone interested.
Thank you. One more hand. There was somebody right in the back, I think, wanting to say something. Is there somebody in the back there? No? Yes? Okay, Dan.
Okay. I wanted to talk a bit more about what Kia was talking about how the poor pay for transition. So I'm quite keen on us having a mass social movement, but I don't have a lot of faith that however radical we think we are here, that we're really up for it. Because I don't know that people are keen to get their hands dirty by talking to people who have really different social views to their own. So I'm just interested about how we think we could build a mass movement within this country and how we could build links with whatever you want to call the global south in a really practical way, because whenever I ask this question, people reply in a really intellectual way. And I'm fond of intellectualism, but I'd also like to know how you think we might practically do it.
Thank you very much for that. I would like to ask Kia and Janos to maybe answer that question and also to refer to the ones that have been asked before.
I'd like anyone to answer that question. That'd be good. part of the answer to that, I think, is to try and link up at the minute we're going through a credit crisis in this country. You know, we're going through this huge sort of perfect storm of crises, basically, which is, you know, because it's a perfect storm of crises, it's extremely difficult to manage. But it also means that, you know, ordinary people in this country are now facing the consequences of like a credit fueled consumer boom that we went through in over the last 20 years or so. Because one thing that never seems to get through to people, and it always seems to be a surprise, is that if you look at real wages, they've been declining in the West since 1979, okay? And so this consumer boom that we've had over the last 10 years has been paid for by credit, okay? So Britain is one of the most indebted countries in the world. And now that's over. Because the credit crunch is here, okay? And so a quarter of the the indebtedness, the personal indebtedness of Britain has paid for a quarter of the industrialization of China. Right? All these things are interlinked, and you know, the credit crisis is also a climate crisis and peak oil crisis. You know, so it's only by sort of like changing our ideas about like green issues as some sort of specialist thing that we can solve. You know, they don't concern ordinary people. You know, I think there is a real chance that that could change. If we think about the credit, you know, mortgage repayments are intimately linked to climate change. All right. And the thing about the Kyoto, and I'm not sure about all this, but you know, I think that you have to, you know, we have to delegitimize that round of negotiations or that round of agreements, you know, so it has to be a nice simple slogan like no to Kyoto, as far as I can see.
Yes, I'm of course going to talk about Copenhagen. And answer some of the questions. What the discussions about? There was a question about what we are going to do in Copenhagen. What would like be the answer to this meeting? Are we going to shut it down or going to block it? And there have been a lot of discussion in Denmark and also a lot of discussion in international forums and mailing lists. And of course, the problem. It is different from G8 because, first of all, it's not just the three most powerful people in the world coming there. There are also many other countries represented, and why they are there is not to spread. New liberal economy and stuff like that. They are there to, as they say, save our climate, and in the media it looks really bad. It's political, extremely bad, to say we want to close it down. That has been the argument. On the other hand, and the other one, then there has also been some arguing to close it down because we know that it is bad. But the question is, so far we have reached, we don't want to go any longer in this discussion before we have a big international meeting in September in Denmark, a week before the International Social Forum, which is going to happen in Malmö. And there we'll discuss, along with other things such as the International Climate Camp, what will be the reaction to that. That's one point. I want to talk a little about how much we can trust that this meeting is going to give us anything good, because if we look at the Kyoto Protocol, and I talked a little about it before, all it did was to create a new market, and what it did, it capitalized the air. That's what it did. It took all the air, and then it said there is a price on the air. And if you pollute something, then you have used the air and thereby bought the air. And then you can sell air to each other, and that makes a capital circulation, which helps the economy because it's good for the capitalism to produce and use things. So actually what this did, it sold something which is completely fundamental to the entire survival of the Earth population. It sold our air. That's what they did the last time they agreed something. That is not good. That is seriously not good. So I really hope they're going to make a better deal this time. I'm not sure that they will, but we will be there, and we will come with the slogan: if they do not do it, we will. If they do not use the power that they have been given, then we will have to do it because they can't handle that power. They are like immature children who can't handle having responsibility. Okay, and that's all I want to say.
Thank you, Yanis. We are now running 10 minutes over time. It's 10 past nine. Some people might want to have their Kaylee here. I don't know. What do we do? Do we go on in here? Or do we move to the next tent where we would not have a mic? We can go on for a little while. That's good. We're going to do that. Can I see some more hands? Okay, just a second. I think you were first, the man standing up back there, Dan. And then the lady over there. And then you. Okay.
Hi. Copenhagen is not the same as Seattle. What they wanted was more globalization. We wanted to stop that. So it was the right tactics then to stop or try and stop the conference going on. Here, the whole point of it is to try and stop global warming. Now, that's not something we want to get in the way of. What we want to get in the way of is the wrong solutions. So two-week targets, all that sort of stuff. So, and plus, the other thing is, as somebody said, all the stuff happens behind the scenes. It'll be happening before Copenhagen. We've got to influence it before it happens. So what I'm doing is organising this zero carbon caravan around Europe from the spring right through to Copenhagen. We've got to talk to the people. We've got to get the people to pressure the negotiators at Copenhagen at the end of the year to say, we want a zero carbon world. It is possible. The Centre for Alternative Technology in Wales brought out a report last year, Zero Carbon Britain, that proved we can do it in 20 years. So we aim for a zero carbon world by 2030, and it is possible, and we demand that they do it. And we do that by going around Europe, first of all, talking to people, getting involved in local towns, having meetings everywhere, and getting them all to pressure the politicians in the run-up to the summit, which is the time to do it, not at the summit.
Thank you. The lady in front. I can't see her now. Okay, over here.
Kind of on that, I guess if we do believe that any meaningful change is going to happen in Copenhagen, we're going to need to get there to Poznan as well at the end of this year in Poland, because as far as I understand, some of the nitty-gritty has to be nutted out there, and I don't know, I don't think they use consensus up at the UNFCCC necessarily, but they're going to have to start talking some details and stuff in Poznan in December, so we should also be thinking about that for preparation for Copenhagen.
Thank you. There was somebody in front here. Yeah.
Well, there's a few points I wanted to raise. First of all, as we started talking about Copenhagen, I wanted to remind people of what happened in Germany, that's where I live, in Heiligendamm and in Bonn mainly. In one of the big conclusions that are being drawn from the mobilization in Heiligendamm is the fact that we were not able to provide a real antagonistic discourse. In fact, the governments, in particular the German government, were able to picture themselves as climate change solution providers, as savers of the world, and use the legitimacy of the protest in order to reinforce their power and their legitimacy. We actually failed in terms of climate change. If you look at what happened in Bonn, which is, it's not the process within the United Nations about climate, but about biodiversity, you really see that the governments and this global governance, they really control very well how the protest and the so-called civil society and NGOs. They spend a huge amount of money inviting people from all around the world, NGOs, indigenous movements, farmers' movements, and so on and so on. They had them on stage. They had them on TV. Everyone was there. And they managed to draw further legitimization for a project which included more agrofuels, more genetically modified organism as a solution to the food crisis, and so on and so on. So if we want to really make a change in Copenhagen, then we need to really think very carefully that we will not actually provide even more legitimacy for all these false solutions that they are putting forward, as Almut mentioned before, which is carbon trade, agrofuels, and so on and so on. And speaking now about the topic that was here, these false solutions, they come out of I think it's due to a particular mechanism. We cannot really separate the capitalist system, the state, and us, as tonight I had the feeling we tended to do so. We are all reproducing the capitalist system. We are all reproducing the state structure every day. And the system is currently providing a lot of false solutions because it's difficult for people, due to this climate crisis, when they leave their zone of comfort, they all want to get back to normal. And this is why the system is coming up with a lot of so-called false solutions, like carbon trade, and so on. So whatever we do, we will have to tackle that mechanism that keeps making proposals that will ultimately stabilize capitalism. And only that can come from social movements and from grassroots dynamics.
Thank you very much. There are two more hands back there. First you, and then Robin at the back. And then I would like to give you a chance again to say something. Yeah, over there.
They should be using audio or video conferencing rather than traveling to Bali, or they should be using audio and or video conferencing rather than travelling to Indonesia or wherever in the first sodding place, okay? And if they can hear this meeting, it's actually very simple, okay? There are clean energies around. It's much more urgent than people generally believe. It's much more urgent than the governments will believe, because back decades ago, clean energy was not invested in. And that's because the public didn't understand that it's a better investment than more fossil fuel. So, if you go to your place of work and you can tell your colleagues, look, this has real impact for the fundamental quality of your children's life, and then ultimately the actual impossibility of surviving on the planet later on, your colleagues say, I know, I've heard about this, but... Yeah, okay. Your colleagues will say, well, I've heard about this, I know this, but I have to earn my money, I have to go home, I have to get an early night, I can't come camping, which they would love to come and be involved like this. This is the normal, not activist public, okay? So these people have to know a few simple things, is that decade after decade this mistake gets made. Fossil fuels are being invested in the 50s or the 40s or whatever. The clean energies were not invested in, and we are still doing that, okay? But these people, the public, you know, the people who might be listening to this meeting, their children are actually going to be really contemplating whether to have children, right? And, okay, I think we can just about take a point like this, but us activists, we can't necessarily say everything as it is. We're human and we are only strong in numbers. You know, our friends back at work and back at home and back down the pub can't come camping, all of them. Some of us have to work for very long hours. This point is not reaching the public of the UK, and instead you can choose to watch Channel 4
which do they try hard, and occasionally they put real duff films on. It's all about choice, and we need to find a way of a central information feed that is so clear that the public will say, well, this is true, but what we hear in the mainstream media now looks to be untrue. And if that situation was actually found and maintained for a few months, then the government would love to act because they would suddenly find it very, very popular.
Thank you. Up there.
Hi. I've never got used to using microphones. My name's Robin. I wish George Monbiot was here because, like, for a whole year, he's like his comments last year have like aggravated me when I've recalled them to mind. And I was one of the people who was quite keen on having this debate there and like framing the question around the state, like misleading or kind of, you know, as open to kind of like ambiguity as it is. But I think this discussion this evening has enabled us to get to some of the bottom of what this question entails. But for me, I mean, I guess probably we all have a different conception of the state from observation, from experience, from theory, who you know, who you've been propagandized to by, you know, what movements you're involved with. My experience matches with a certain kind of theory of the state that I would have picked up in the socialist movement, and that's, you know, having been around this kind of movement and anarchists and lots of other people, the observation is that, yes, the state oppresses young black people, it beats up Asian people, it, you know, it's quite happy to turn a blind eye while the BNP beats up gay people and does all sorts of, like, nasty things, yeah? But fundamentally, what I see, the apparatus of the state being in place to do is to oppress the working class. Now, there's like people go, oh, like you can feel the, you know, he's mentioned those words, he's a socialist, he's mentioned like the working class, when will they shut up? What about indigenous people? What about women? What about all the other oppressed peoples? Of course, but I think the point actually needs to be hammered home to people here, because is it not conspicuous, the composition of this movement? So when George Monbiot turns around and says the hope is here, why is the hope here? I don't understand. I've never really understood why people think the hope is here. I don't live here 365 days of the world. I don't travel with people like this, of this composition, on the bus every day. Those are the people I live with and feel an immense amount of solidarity with because they suffer like exactly what capitalism is on a day-to-day basis. Not just as a theory, not as an observation. For sure, capitalism is oppressive for everyone. Living in a capitalist society that's dominated by those values, I'm sure it's very awful and morally degrading for the American rich, you know? But it doesn't, bring a tear to my eye, you know? What does bother me, and what I think is kind of, contradictory about the kind of, or what's conspicuous in the absence in these kind of discussions. So there's a lot of talk in anarchism about the, you know, being anti-hierarchical, you know, being for consensus decision-making, for the freedom of the individual and fulfilling our individual potentials. You do that quite a lot. We do that quite a lot of a day, yeah? But the majority of the people that you live with in this country don't. And that is a condition of being, not having any control over your, yes, cultural life is important, but I think what determines it is that when you go home to your family cultural life, you know you've spent the day being treated like a beast of labour, whatever your work is done. So you can free up your cultural terrain, you can free, you know, have lovely community fates. But if you're going to go back to a system like those workers in King's North and know that they're fucking over the planet, what kind of contradictory kind of mindset must you develop? For me, the primary task is fighting that contradiction there that people have to live. If we want liberty, if we want the development of people, then you do have to go to those people that are producing of a day and reproducing of a day this most oppressive system and that oppresses himself, which most other sections, young black youth don't do that in that same way. Other people don't do that. They don't drive this system. They don't have that contradictory kind of potential there. But on the positive side of it, these people have developed a solidarity that is not possible. For those people to liberate themselves, the levels of solidarity that are implicit and necessary by that, a mammoth...
Robin, keep it short.
Yeah, no, you're right, I should keep it short, but I do feel that these views are grossly underrepresented at this camp.
Thank you. Thank you for presenting that view to us. Now, I don't know. The lines are thinning a bit here. What do you think? I think we should roll it up, and we should maybe give a last chance to our speakers to say a very few words, and then we should go and party. Yeah? Should we do that? Yeah? Okay. Okay, Almut.
Yeah, I think, you know, from what Robin said, I think, you know, the important thing is for all of us to remember that, you know, we are not here because we have the answers, and we won't come home saying that, you know, climate camp has the answers. You know, the answers will come from, you know, from as many people as possible, from, you know, as many communities as possible, you know, throughout the UK, throughout the world, engaging and working together. And, you know, what we need to do is seeing, you know, where, how we define, how we see the problems, what, you know, what contribution we can make, we want to make, and, you know, continue seeing ourselves as just one part of that process. I thought there were quite a few sort of comments on the Copenhagen issue that I thought I might get back to, and I'm sure others, you know, on the role of the state, the other speakers will get back and expand on that. I do agree with those people who can see, you know, the real problems of saying that shut the whole thing down, but I think there's also the, you know, possibility of ever possibly having, you know, big counter, you know, counter event, counter summit, etc. And I think that's obviously something that the international movement will, you know, the movement of mobilizing that will be, you know, will be debating and discussing, and, you know, I don't know which way it's going to go. I would go back to what I said earlier, and I think what somebody said, you know, comparing with Heiligendamm is really important, is that we need to look at the processes, and we need to look at the process of Kyoto and the process of the Copenhagen negotiations, and not look at the promise, not primarily focus on nice promises and nice targets. Now, what we have at the moment is that some of the most radical-sounding governments on climate change, that everybody sort of, well, not everybody, but say other governments sort of almost see as, wow, you know, to live up to, is, for example, in Germany, where they are going for 80% cuts by 2050 and having a very radical program on expanding non-fossil fuel energy, which is all good and well, except that, you know, despite with all they are going, they are also promoting, you know, continuing to promote massive carbon trading and massive economic growth. And despite the fact that they have, you know, that they have greatly expanded renewables, they've actually got the fastest growth in fossil fuel emissions anywhere in Europe at the same time. So, you know, looking at what, you know, even the so-called progressive governments are putting forward, being actually pretty certain to lead to global climatic meltdown and to, you know, to run away climate change, I think we have to be, you know, very, very, very critical and, you know, really focus on the legitimacy of the process, on the mechanisms being offered, and, you know, say very clearly no to, you know, the market mechanisms and the market-based solutions for climate change. We're not saying no to, you know, action on climate change, you know, I think, but I do think we need to say no to, you know, the market solutions being put forward, because they will considerably worsen problems and actually stand in the way of real and true solutions that, you know, all of us will have to play one little part in helping to formulate.
Thank you very much. Janusz, I would like you to go next.
First of all, for the very long question by the guy down there, I agree completely with you. The 1st of May this year, I held a speech with the title Class Struggle is Climate Struggle. And it's true, it's completely connected. And I want to give an example on how of course these days the class system is global, and I want to give us a example on how the rich part of the world will react on when the climate shifts and all these. There will be resource wars and big immigrations and oil wars, and we have already seen the oil wars in Iraq. An example is I read some bits and pieces from a report by the Pentagon in America on how they will react on as a national security question. It's a national security question in the Pentagon now, and it's very frightening to read because it has this very cold kind of language. It's almost like reading a letter about how much tax you're going to pay this month. It sounds kind of like it could sound like this: the there will be a decrease of the Earth's capacity to sustain a certain amount of people on certain areas or something like that. It's very very cold. It's very terrible to read it, and it doesn't say anything about global solidarity. It doesn't say anything about helping people. What it says is that there will be this decrease very coldly. They describe this, and then they describe what is going to be done about it. And this is a national security report from Pentagon. And what they describe is to build up fences, and they have to build walls to keep up, to keep out the people who trying to get into America. This is what they very clearly describes, and it's the same as Ford Europe, as I talked about earlier. There are two answers. There are two answers that the West can do when this happens. Either we can go this way, which seems very likely right now, as the system is right now, or we can go the other way, which is global solidarization with all classes.
Thank you very much, Janusz. And now for the very, very last word on this.
I will be short. Just to talk about the guy who raised the working class and stuff like that. And I think, you know, the work is this huge problem. Actually, having a workshop on this tomorrow as under the name of the Free Association. But Thursday, sorry, yes. But part of the problem is, right, there's been a huge lengthening in the working week. I know, and work, the difference between work and leisure is broken down. I mean, a huge part of the consumption, it's a massive increase in consumption that we have to do. And the reason that people want to fly away on holidays for weekend breaks is that, you know, we have a very short amount of time to reproduce ourselves. Right? So you need a dishwasher. You need all these other things, you know what I mean? And you need ready meals. You haven't got time to cook. You know, there's this huge pressure. It's this vertiginous pressure of, like, increased work, basically. You know, and I think part of the struggle for climate change is the struggle to reduce the working week. I'm not talking about... One of the first struggles of the working classes in the, you know, 80s, and it was a struggle for the eight-hour week, the struggle to invent the weekend, all right? You know, these things didn't happen by accident. They were struggled and fought for. And part of the reason you do that is you increase the capacity for people to organize, to do other projects, to have more time under their own control, basically. So, yeah. I think this could be a positive feedback loop that we could try and get to combat the negative feedback loop of climate change running away. Is that the more time you have for struggle, you know, I find being in this sort of environment really infectious, right? You can feel, you have more time of your own control, and you can feel, you know, acting together, you can feel your increased capacities to do things collectively, you know. That is the dynamic, infectious thing that the only dynamism that overcomes is more than the dynamism of capital, right? Is this feeling of, that's all, you know, increasing our capacities to act on the world around us, and increasing the control over our lives, basically, and that's what it's all about. All right.
Thank you, Keir. Thank you to all our panelists. Thank you to Dan for helping out, and thank you to the people on the lights and the mics. And thank you, all of you, for being here, for listening, for giving us your ideas about this. Go out and work, and go out and have fun, and go out and change the world. And Let's dance. Okay, off we go.